a day of remembrances here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. On Bastille Day, the French city of Nice remembers the 86 people killed in a terrorist attack a year ago today.
This is a place where there's always been people coming in and out from different areas, speaking different languages, practicing different religion, and that should go on in Nice.
Also, we remember South African AIDS activist Prudence Mabele.
She held scientists accountable, she held politicians accountable, and she held communities accountable, ensuring that we all did better and were better.
Plus,
this week was the week that I started seeing air conditioning not just as the foe of cold office workers everywhere, but providing a potential opportunity in the fight against climate change.
We'll explain how today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Choir paying tribute to the 86 people who died in the French city of Nice a year ago today. On Bastille Day last year, a man drove a truck into crowds of people celebrating Independence Day along the city's beachside promenade. Hundreds were also injured. It's a painful memory for Nice. Gaetan Antiniente is a volunteer tour guide there. We spoke with him today. He says it was hard to start giving tours again after the attack. And for many people in Nice, he told me, it still feels fresh.
I'm sure that it's still painful for a majority of them. You know, it's very difficult for me, for example, to walk along the Corniche and the promenade without thinking of what had happened. You know, it's, still, I mean, people are fighting and, against that feeling and trying to go on.
What about yourself? How have you changed in the past year?
It's difficult. I mean, it was difficult for me to go back on the strolls. But then I thought that, you know, I had to go back to it. And strangely enough, the first two couple I had were Algerian Muslim who wanted to take a tour.
So you were basically doing one of your tours of Nice and you had this couple of Algerians taking the tour?
Yeah, that was my first after the attacks. One of the two was a doctor-to-be in the next years, young woman. And cousin was an engineer, you know, and we started the tour from the promenade, but very quickly I decided to walk downtown, the old part of the city. They realized then that I was not really well, because it's difficult to tell stories about Nice and history when the attacks were still so strongly and powerfully present in my mind. So they started, first of all, they really made the point that in no way they would support what that guy did on that night. And they trying to show me there were other generations of young people fighting against the same people and that they would support anything that would help us. So they're absolutely fantastic. And it was my first stroll with two people from an Arabic-speaking country. So I found it very, very strange to have them. And it really helped me overcome some of the pain at the time.
And today, when you give tours, how do you talk about those attacks when you're leading tourists down the Corniche?
I don't, except when I'm asked questions. I don't want people to get that vision of Nice. I mean, there are so many things to be said about Nice. But if they ask questions, I let them know my feelings and what happened and how it happened. Yeah.
How would you say the city has changed in the last year?
It's always difficult to say. I mean, I think that people are a little less happy that they were, perhaps less smiling, a little worried. You can see that there's still some tension every time there's a strange noise. I mean, there's something, it's something that could be of some interest. There's a tradition in Nice since the 19th century. There's a cannon shot at lunchtime, and it's very powerful.
They shoot it on the Corniche?
Yeah, they do that just as a reminder that this is noon. And it seems to be totally anecdotal, but it's interesting to see that people react physically every time they hear it. So this is something very precise that shows that there's still some of that feeling of worry or fear. So there's little changes in the attitude in terms of security and safety. People are a little worried.
How are you celebrating Bastille Day this year, Gaetan?
No.
You're not at all?
No.
Just staying at home.
Staying at home with the grandchildren, yes, and the rest of the family coming. No. It's difficult to celebrate anything for the time being. It's 1 year only.
Yeah. And what about the general celebrations for Bastille Day on the street? Is security
it
on
worked.
High alert?
People were back to, all the celebration were back to normal. You know, they were exactly the same thing as usual, but no fireworks tonight, obviously. No fireworks.
Gaëtan Ottignente in Nice, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The truck attack in Nice wasn't the only act of terrorism that took place a year ago today. Dozens of other incidents are recorded in the Global Terrorism Database for July 14th, 2016. Our data team here at The World has created an online interactive tool that allows you to explore the Global Terrorism Database. You can check it out right now at PRI.org. And to help us understand how it works, I've got Alex Newman and Sophie Chow here in the studio with me, two of the members of our data team. Okay, Alex, what exactly are we looking at here?
If you open up the application, it starts with just a count of how many incidents happened every day. So today in 2016, there were 37 incidents, including the attack in Nice.
Right. So we could go to any country and pick any date to find out what happened on that day?
Absolutely, yes.
So just for example, let's go to Iraq on July 14th, 2016. What happened on that day?
So in Iraq in 2016, a year ago today, there were 19 different incidents and 11 separate deaths. The reason we're showing you incidents and deaths is because these are two different things. Something like 40% of incidents don't have any fatalities.
And as you scroll down the page, there's a bar graph. What does that indicate?
These two charts, one shows us the number of incidents where you can see Iraq on the top. Mm. There was also 4 incidents in the Philippines, 2 in Somalia, 2 in Nigeria, and 2 in Libya. And those were the top 5 countries. But then if you look at deaths, you see a different selection of countries. So you see France with 87 deaths, followed by Libya, followed by Iraq, Nigeria, and the Philippines.
So that's pretty extraordinary because all we heard about a year ago, mostly, was Nice. And yet there were all these other attacks in many other places.
Yeah, that's exactly the idea behind the interactive, is that we do hear predominantly stories from the West. We hear about the Manchester bombings. We hear about the attacks in Nice. We hear about the Orlando shootings. But there are a massive amount of attacks occurring every day, predominantly in the Middle East.
Sophie Chow, you've been analyzing this data for a couple of months now. What are some of your key findings?
One thing that was really interesting to me was that although the number of hostage-taking and kidnapping incidents went down last year, the number of people who were held hostage nearly doubled in 2016. And it's attributed to these really massive abductions, mostly by ISIS in Iraq, where almost entire villages are held hostage and taken away. Mm-hmm.
Anything else in your findings?
I think one thing, even though I knew about this, it was helpful to put in perspective just how rare attacks in the West are. For example, like all of last year, there were 36 fatal attacks in the West. But that's one less than the daily average worldwide.
Are there incidents that are not represented in these data?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly hard to keep track of terror attacks. And these incidents in the database are only ones that have media reports. So anything that's not covered by the media is not included. Another thing is that by definition set by this database, acts of violence that are carried out by governments are not included. So anything with state actors is not included.
Question for both of you. I mean, I kind of feel there's a perception that the world is a terrible place these days where you could get killed anywhere you go. So where's the value of these objective numbers when subjectively people often see the world as an increasingly violent place?
One good takeaway is that there was less terror in 2016 compared to the year before. There is like 10% less attacks overall. And I think the other thing that's really helpful is these numbers help put your risk in perspective.
Alex, what's your take?
Well, I think sometimes Americans do often list terrorism as a number one priority to the president, to Congress, and as a problem in the United States. And I think this helps you see what we perceive as terrorism is not at all close to the daily reality of the lives of people around the world.
Alex Newman and Sophie Chow with the World's Data Team, thanks so much for coming in and telling us about it.
Thank you, Marco.
You know how the date for a momentous event can become shorthand for what happened? For Nice, it'll be 7/14. For us, 9/11. In Turkey, it's July 15th. A year ago, a military faction attempted to overthrow the elected government. The coup failed, and a crackdown on suspected coup supporters continues. As for July 15th, it's a holiday now, but not everyone in Turkey is celebrating. Alexandra Locke has the story from Istanbul.
The cobblestone pier in Ortaköy is full of tourists and locals. They're aiming for that coveted selfie with an Istanbul icon, the Bosphorus Bridge. Or is that the July 15th Martyrs Bridge? That's the official new name, in honor of those who died during last year's military coup attempt. In daily life, though, the name depends on who you ask.
I hope July 15th is remembered so that the martyrs aren't forgotten. That's why they changed the name of the bridge, and I think it's good.
To me, the old name was nicer. It's identified with Istanbul.
The new name comes from a dramatic showdown on the night of the coup attempt, when ordinary civilians marched on tanks blocking the bridge. One of them was 20-year-old Batuhan Ergin. He lost his life that night. Batuhan's father, Ahmet Ergin, found these videos on his son's phone. Batuhan is on the bridge, shouting, "Soldiers, back to the barracks!" He looks exhilarated, like he can't believe his eyes. His father keeps the videos on his own phone now.
The last time I spoke to him, I said, "Batuhan, my son, come home." The night of the coup attempt, he went to the bridge with his friend. He fought against the soldiers there. And that night, he became a martyr with one bullet to his heart.
The government named a school after Batuhan, and Ergin says their street and the bus stop will also be renamed. Ergin says he tries to take comfort in all these things to honor his son, but he's still grieving.
It feels like yesterday to us. I can't believe how it's been a year.
July 15th is now part of Turkish history, and the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wants to make sure people never forget. It's unveiling new monuments this week, and it's already renamed schools, mosques, bus stops, swimming pools, even an entire neighborhood, all in honor of July 15th. Some Erdogan supporters are even calling the coup attempt the Second Independence War. To say I've heard this song 100 times in the last year is probably a low estimate. It was a campaign song once, but now it's an anthem. Erdogan's supporters had it on repeat last year for weeks at public rallies, celebrating his role in the victory for Turkish democracy. Asla Aydintashbaş is a columnist with Cumhuriyet. That's an opposition paper, and currently 12 of its journalists are in prison.
The government is changing the name of all these places because it's an effort to rewrite the history of the republic. Nation building is essentially about creating myths, flags, stories, heroism, martyrdom, etc. And we are seeing it in the works.
Erdogan has long had a vision of what he calls a new Turkey, where Muslims can make religion part of public life. That's in direct conflict with the staunchly secular vision of Turkey's founding father, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Aydintashbaş says it's a tragedy that the coup attempt didn't unite people, and she thinks Erdogan's ruling party, the AKP, has polarized the anniversary as well.
And that's really sad because this coup was not just about AKP. It was essentially a move against Turkish democracy, and therefore Turkish people of all stripes should have been celebrating its defeat.
July 15th led to a mass purge aimed at alleged supporters of the coup attempt. Over 100,000 people have been fired from their jobs, and some 50,000 have been arrested. Most say they had nothing to do with the coup. It all makes for a strange atmosphere for a new holiday when so many people feel there's little to celebrate. A year has passed, but there's still no consensus on this latest chapter in Turkey's history, no matter what you call it. For the world, Alexandra Locke, Istanbul.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. She's been called the Pied Piper of the brokenhearted and a true South African hero. Prudence Mabele stepped onto the global stage in 1992 when she became the first South African woman to disclose that she was HIV positive. From then on, Mabele became an activist for the rights of anyone who was HIV positive, and she helped millions get access to HIV treatment. Back in 2010, Mabele imagined a future free of AIDS.
for those who are younger to stay AIDS-free. I would like to see that instant. Maybe when one day when I'm 50 or 55, I look back and I say we have worked because it's, you know, it's controllable.
Prudence Mabele did not live to see that day. She died this week at the age of 46. Ambassador Deborah Birx is the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator. She heads PEPFAR, the U.S. program supporting HIV-AIDS treatment and prevention around the world. Ambassador Birx, I know you knew Prudence Mabele. How will you remember her?
I remember her as a vibrancy and an absolutely passionate for changing the course of this pandemic and compassionate for everyone around her. You know, she represented the best of us, an individual willing to the very end to make that personal sacrifice really of her own health to absolutely ensure that others had access to treatment and that others had access to prevention. I'm always astounded by the AIDS movement because I think it's uniquely where advocates and activism have come together, even when they are the most sickest, and say, we want something different for others. And I think that selflessness, that willing to look past their own individual suffering and see the suffering of others while they're in the midst of suffering themselves, that kind of humanity is so humbling. When you think of how she had to confront this pandemic in 92, how she had to go through the time when oftentimes in South Africa, they didn't acknowledge that HIV, the virus, was the cause of the pandemic, yet she was that voice. And we should all be asking the question, would we be willing to make that same personal sacrifice that she made that in the end cost her life?
Yeah, well, you touched on it there. I mean, these are different times from when Prudence Mabele was fighting to help people with HIV in 1992. How important was it for people like her to speak up when nobody else was?
You cannot imagine the stigma and discrimination that was rampant at that time. You can't imagine how she must have personally suffered at the hands of so many individuals who acted like she was the only one. And what had she done to get HIV/AIDS? In the 90s, as the 80s were here, it was such a difficult time for people to be able to confront their illness personally, because there wasn't the life-saving drug combinations that we didn't even have that combination drugs until 96. Yet to stand up when they knew that there was nothing for them at the time and there wasn't life-saving drugs as we know it, yet they were willing to vocally demonstrate that this had to be discussed and we had to do something different. I think she held scientists accountable, she held politicians accountable, and she held communities accountable, ensuring that we all did better and were better. And I think it's astounding how much impact she had.
Yeah, I mean, one of the politicians she held accountable notoriously was South African President Thabo Mbeki, who was a man who criticized, even denied, the scientific consensus that HIV causes AIDS. How much of an impact did those years of AIDS denialism have on the rate of infection?
You ask a critical question, and to go back and do those modelings, I think it not only at the time allowed the virus to spread because obviously people weren't on effective drugs and they weren't being virally suppressed. You know, if people like Prudence had been treated when they were diagnosed, she would be thriving now. We really have to recognize how much the immune system is crippled even when you feel well. And I think Prudence continued with the fight, even though she had such substantial damage to her immune system that would never be corrected with drugs alone. And I think this is how many people have had to live with the virus. And I think she committed herself to ensure that other young women and other young men didn't have the same experience that she had. And I think anytime people tell people to stop their medications, or tell people that they don't need medications to stop this virus, they're just as guilty as the president when he denied that HIV was causing AIDS, the virus. So I think it's important for all, whenever we hear someone say that you don't need to be on medication, we need to remember prudence and really rail against that.
And yet, despite the best efforts of so many activists like Prudence Mabele, South Africa has the highest number of citizens infected with HIV than any other country in the world. Why?
I think there's two reasons. They don't have the highest prevalence. And so this really, people have to always understand that burden of disease is based on, you know, the actual number of people who have the disease. But if Swaziland and Lesotho had a population of South Africa, they would far exceed South Africa in the number of HIV positives. So, I mean, South Africa has been very aggressive in their response to HIV/AIDS under Minister of Health Moseleti, and I think they are really beginning to change the curve of the pandemic, and I think they will be able to change the curve of the pandemic. But it will take really raising this awareness among young people. And the way to honor Prudence for all of us who recognize her contribution is for every South African under 35 to know their HIV status so they can access treatment that could save their lives.
She had so much impact. That's what I'm hearing from you. What do you think Prudence Mabele's most important legacy will be?
Her commitment to others being greater than her commitment to herself.
Ambassador Deborah Birx, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator. She also heads PEPFAR, the U.S. program supporting HIV/AIDS treatment and prevention programs around the world. Ambassador Birx, thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about Prudence.
And just ahead of the break, here's a quick update to a story we brought you earlier this month about an all-girl robotics team from Afghanistan. The six girls worked for months to build a robot for an international robotics competition in Washington, D.C. Then it came time for them to get the paperwork to actually come to the U.S. They traveled 500 miles from their homes in western Afghanistan to the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. They made that journey twice, and their visa applications were denied both times. But earlier this week, the girls got some good news. They'd be allowed to come to the U.S. after all.
They are very excited, and of course, they were surprised and happy.
Roya Makhboob is credited with being Afghanistan's first female tech CEO. She's been working with the young engineers throughout this process. She says the girls got visas to travel to the U.S. after President Trump intervened. When the team got the news, they had to move quickly so they wouldn't miss the competition.
I think it was only a few hours that they have to pick up the clothes and get a ticket and come to Kabul.
The first global challenge opens this weekend in Washington, D.C. And at the opening ceremony, the Afghan girls are scheduled to lead a procession of teams from nearly 160 countries. I'm Marco Werman. Two high school journalists score an interview with the U.S. Secretary of Defense.
It was really interesting to hear someone who's living history explain it to you, reiterating and reinforcing the points that our history teachers have made, but to have it be someone in his position.
45 minutes with Mad Dog Mattis. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. One president already impeached, the current one facing a potential corruption trial before the country's Supreme Court, and a former president who wants to run again, now convicted of corruption and sentenced to years in jail. And we're talking about the country's three recent heads of state. Washington's going to have to work hard to catch up to the executive chaos in Brazil. Reporter Will Carlos is based in Rio de Janeiro and has been following the latest twists in this ongoing political drama. Will, the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff last year for financial mismanagement, that's old news. But let's talk about the other two, starting with former President Lula da Silva, Dilma's predecessor. What is Lula accused of?
So Lula's accused basically of receiving a bribe, essentially, in the form of an apartment that he had access to in the small seaside town of Guarujá, which is just outside São Paulo. Allegedly, he had access to that apartment. He got some work done, a kitchen remodeled, and some other sort of ancillary things. It's important to note that this is kind of the one that stuck. You know, he's accused of all sorts of different things. This is the one that prosecutors thought would be the easiest charge to bring against him. So this is what they pursued. And he was just found guilty and then sentenced to more than 9 years in prison.
It's all a bit weird for Lula because his reputation in Brazil is pretty shiny, isn't it?
It is. I mean, less and less shiny as we go along. But it's not so much that it's shiny. It's that he's sort of the boy that done good. You know, I mean, he came from nothing. He grew up very, very poor. His mother was illiterate, and he kind of came out of nowhere and ended up running the country for 2 terms for 8 years. So, I mean, this is the big success story, and ran the country when Brazil was doing very well, too. So his fall from grace is sort of very emblematic of Brazil's general fall from grace.
What is Lula's defense in this whole corruption scandal?
Bluster, basically, if I had to sum it up in one word. His defense is, I haven't done anything. These are trumped up charges. You know, and that resonates with a lot of Brazilians because it comes on the back of the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, which we've talked a lot about on the show, you know, that a lot of people see as a politically motivated way of getting rid of somebody on the left wing because the right wing couldn't win elections. Well, Lula's saying that this is basically a judicial version of what happened to Dilma. He's saying they're just trying to get rid of me because I was going to run for re-election next year and everyone knows I would win and they want me out of the picture by putting me in jail.
Right. With other personalities, this would be a blow to their political careers. But as you say, Lula suggested he's going to run for president next year and it looks like he'll have support. Can he even run again?
So that is the real million-dollar question right now. As things stand right now, he can run. He can run for re-election. He can be elected president. And if he is elected president, then he has immunity for any crimes that he committed prior to his term. So theoretically, he could run for another 2 terms and he would have immunity, wouldn't go to jail throughout that whole time. This guy is over 70, so I mean, that would take him well into his later years. Now, that is because his case is still being appealed. If that appeal is heard between now and the election, and if he is indeed found guilty and sentenced, then he wouldn't be able to run. He would be barred for running for something like 18, 19 years, wouldn't be able to run for president, and obviously wouldn't win.
Quickly, what is the case against current president Michel Temer, and will he face trial?
As far as the second question, I don't know. Nobody really knows. He would have to be actually impeached as a sitting president. 2/3 of the House would have to vote to impeach him. It's fairly unlikely, but I mean, the case against him seems to be getting stronger. He's also accused of receiving something like $150,000. Again, that's one of many accusations against him. That's the one that prosecutors have chosen to go with. But he has that presidential immunity right now that we talked about. So the way to get at him is to impeach him as they did Dilma Rousseff. If you'd asked me a few months ago whether that was going to happen, I would have told you no, it was very unlikely. People didn't have the stomach for it. I'm wavering now. I think there is a chance that he could be impeached before the elections next year. It's anyone's guess, really.
So Lula, Dilma, and now Temer, the third Brazilian leader who's been accused of corruption recently. What is morale like in Brazil these days?
Well, it depends. I mean, people hate politicians, but people have always hated politicians in Brazil for as long as I can remember. And I grew up as a kid here. You know, people have always kind of treated politicians with scorn. Morale is actually not that bad in some ways because people see this as the sort of the judiciary's moment. This is the time that the judiciary is kind of rode in on their white horse and is kind of cleaning up the corruption of Brazil. And the hope is that Brazil comes out of this, you know, a cleaner, less corrupt, better run place. The problem is that nobody can sort of point at any politicians that aren't corrupt and that are waiting in the wings to take over from all these people that are getting indicted and thrown in jail. So that's the tricky bit. It is messy and it is, you know, unfortunate for the people that were in power. But what's clearly emerged over the last few years of these prosecutions is that, you know, Brazil was being run by a cabal of deeply corrupt people. So exposing that, getting that out in the open can only be good for the future of the country.
Reporter Will Carlos in Rio. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
I've got reporter Maria Muriel with me, and I gather you've been digging into a book, Maria, by a writer we've had on the show before, Edvige Danticat.
Yes. We love Edvige here at The World, and actually she currently resides in my hometown of Miami. And her latest book is called The Art of Death, Writing the Final Story.
Now, this is not a novel like her usual books, right?
Right. This is actually a nonfiction book, and it is a book about the art of writing. And more specifically, it's about writing about death.
Right. And that's a topic she's fairly familiar with.
Yeah, that's true. She wrote this book, this other book that's pretty popular called Brother, I'm Dying. And that's the story of her father and her uncle's death sort of happening on a parallel. And also, Edwige had family who unfortunately perished in the 2010 earthquake in Haiti. But we mostly talked about this book as a way of her dealing with her mother's death.
Okay, Maria, let's hear your conversation with Edwige Danticat.
Tell me about this book, Edwige. What drove you to take on this project?
Well, after my mom passed away in 2014, there was just nothing I felt compelled to write. And then friends started sending me poems and books about grief and mourning. So I started writing this book as a way of processing my grief, and also because I also had this feeling that I would not be able to write anything else until I had dealt with my grief. And one of the things that I think grief also can be so cultural in many ways. So for example, when my mother's mother died, she went to Haiti to the funeral, and she came back, and she wore black all the time, and then gradually wore lighter colors. There was a mourning period in which you wore black clothes. And I pretty much wear black all the time in my regular life, just as sort of part of my clothes choices. And so I didn't have many rituals in that way. And I was often shocked how quickly people wanted me to get back to my life, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just felt also like a lack of rituals, and writing was very helpful in that, in sort of creating a ritual of my own.
There's something about earthquakes in The Art of Death. And I know that the Haiti earthquake, you went to Haiti after you heard, and you had some family who died in the mm-hmm. earthquake. I wonder if there's like a larger metaphor for what an earthquake means when a person's life ends.
Well, in one of the books that I took with me to Haiti right after the earthquake when I went back was Haruki Murakami's After the Quake. Mm-hmm. And it's a series of short stories about what happens to people after they've gone through this experience. And one of the things that one of the characters says is that, you know, the earth has become liquid. And once the earth becomes liquid, sort of nothing is stable anymore. Like even if the ground under your feet are shifting, it's you don't have any other, you know, there are few anchors left. And I think that speaks to a lot about how people experience just death in general. The ground shifts under your feet. You know, your placing in the world, if it's a parent, feels different.
When you're talking about your mother and you were talking about, you know, the period before she died, she was recording tapes for you, for your family. Was there anything that surprised you sort of as you were crafting this book after her death?
I was surprised by how much she had accepted the fact that she was dying, because it was an ongoing question for me, because, you know, you get the diagnosis, the doctor tells you that you're terminal. Actually, the doctor told her very carefully, but told me more openly that she had maybe 3 months left. He didn't give her the numbers, but I wasn't sure how much of that she accepted. It was also complicated by the fact that she was a person of very strong faith, and the idea of possibly having a miracle was always, you know, part of our conversation. But the cassettes, you know, the words that she recorded, which I heard afterwards, indicated to me clearly that she knew that she would not be around for very long and wanted to have final words and wanted to certain things that she was holding in her heart heard.
Do you think that we try, like as a society, that we shy away from death?
I think some societies, that's why it's very cultural. I think, you know, in some cultures, death might be embraced. In others, it might be made fun of. But I think if we did constantly think about our mortality, we would not live. And at the same time, when you read the work of people who are dying, they're urging us to live as though we were dying, right? But many of us, in order to live peacefully, have to forget that we're dying. But what I've most learned is that death is about living, right? When we mourn people, we mourn the life that they have lived. Dying people, when they write or when they speak, like my mother, even in her cassettes, urge us to live.
Edwige Danticat, author of Claire of the Sea Light and Brother, I'm Dying. Her latest book, out this week, is The Art of Death, Writing the Final Story. She was speaking with The World's Maria Muriel. When it's hot outside, it's nice to have air conditioning inside, right? Well, yes and no. My colleague Carolyn Beeler here in the newsroom has a beef with the AC. She's on The World's Environment Desk.
I do have a beef with air conditioning, and it's mostly that all summer while it's hot outside, I am generally freezing indoors in air-conditioned spaces, especially here in the newsroom. I always have a sweater on the back of my chair, and I'm going to show you, I busted out my boots again,
Like dead of winter boots.
Yeah, pulled them out of the closet. I'm not alone in this. A lot of people are cold in their offices, but I know that by definition, this is a first world problem. There are a lot of places in the world where temperatures get dangerously hot and people can't afford or don't have access to air conditioning. So I get that. But I feel like my dislike of air conditioning at some times is somewhat justified because air conditioning just is not great for the environment.
Well, I feel your pain here in the newsroom, which feels sometimes like a meat locker. Remind us, though, why ACs especially are such a disaster for the environment.
The first thing is the refrigerant that is in air conditioning, hydrofluorocarbons, is almost 2,000 times worse for the climate than carbon dioxide. And air conditioning just uses a lot of electricity, which we generally get by burning fossil fuels.
So how big a contributor is air conditioning to climate change, like right now?
Right now, it's not a huge part of the climate change puzzle, but that's largely because many people in the hottest parts of the world can't afford air conditioning. But that's quickly changing. And I have a crazy statistic that I want to share with you. Around the mid-90s, something like 5% of urban Chinese households had air conditioning. By 2012, something like 120% of urban Chinese households had air conditioning, meaning there were more than one air conditioner units in a lot of households.
Gotcha. I was scratching my head.
Yeah. So a lot of experts think places like India are about to follow the same trajectory. So if this proliferation of AC goes on unchecked, hydrofluorocarbons alone could be something like 1/5 of the whole world's greenhouse gas emissions.
But I gather something happened this week that made you rethink your beef with air conditioning just a little bit, and that's what you want to tell us about.
Yes, I had a minor air conditioning epiphany, if epiphanies can be minor. It was this study out of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California that highlighted this idea that if we sort of improve or fix our air conditioning, it could prevent something like 1 degree of global warming by the end of the century, which is a pretty big deal.
And how do they suggest we do that? Just like set our thermostats higher?
I wish, Marco, but no. The first thing is phasing out hydrofluorocarbons, those potent greenhouse gases, which nearly 200 countries have already said that they are going to do. They said that last year, and we've talked about that on the show before. But importantly, also, while that transition is happening, also transitioning to much more energy-efficient technology for air conditioners. Now, some of this technology is on the market. These are not foregone conclusions that these transitions are going to happen. But the researchers who wrote this study really wanted to highlight the opportunity that efficiency presents rather than other things like driving electric cars. So this week was the week that I started seeing air conditioning not just as the foe of cold office workers everywhere, but providing a potential opportunity in the fight against climate change.
Carolyn Beeler covers the environment for us here at The World, usually while wearing at least one sweater. Carolyn, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
In May, The Washington Post published a picture that accidentally revealed the private cell phone number of the Secretary of Defense. The Post later took the picture down from its website, but not before several people made note of how to contact Jim Mad Dog Mattis, including two students from Mercer Island High School in Washington State. Teddy Fisher and Jane Gormley called, left a voicemail message, and sent a text asking Mattis for an interview for their school paper. And Mattis got back to them, which is not what the two students were expecting.
No. I thought he wouldn't take it seriously, so that's why the text wasn't that serious. I just said, hi, Jim, and then I explained who it was, my position at the paper. I made sure to include my home state because Jim Mattis is also from Washington, so I knew that that would make a connection. So I just said my grade, my school, our paper. I think I ended the text with, by the way, your number got leaked to the American public. Have a wonderful day.
So how much time did he accord you?
I was on the phone with him 45 minutes.
Wow.
Which is pretty crazy. When we were prepping for the interview, we were thinking we were only going to get a few minutes, maybe 10 at the most. And so when Mattis just kept going, Teddy did a really good job of building off the questions that we'd already written and coming up with some on the spot to keep the interview going.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a fascinating interview. You spoke a lot about history and James Mattis's own interest in history. What did your interview do to your sense of history or why countries and generals go to war?
Well, I've always been interested in history, and I've had a lot of great history teachers, and they've all told me the same thing that Mattis said, which is that looking to history won't give you all the answers, but will give you a lot of the questions to ask, which I think is just so much more impactful coming from a guy like that. And he also talked about using history to explore ways in which notable people have dealt successfully and unsuccessfully with matters relating to warfare, foreign policy, politics.
Yeah, I think that there are parts of the interview that almost read or sound like something that you would hear in a history class. It was really interesting to hear someone who's living history explain it to you.
There's been a lot of talk about America's place in the world since Donald Trump took office. We're out of the Paris Climate Agreement, seemingly ceding global muscle to Russia and China, being ostracized, it seems, by a lot of Europe. How do you both feel about America's place in the world? And how did you feel after speaking with Mattis about this?
Well, Mattis made a point when we were talking about history to say that many nations, including the United States, have been through much worse. And if you become politically involved or just involved in your community, you can play a role in getting through tough times. So I wouldn't be too worried. I think he said in the New Yorker that the biggest threat to the United States is a lack of political unity. And we asked mm-hmm. him about that in our interview.
Mm-hmm. I think that just as a young person in mm-hmm. our country today, it was really reassuring to hear that kind of advice and that mindset coming from someone in his position.
He's urging you to get involved, play a role, don't mm-hmm. judge people quickly. A lot of people pointed out that Secretary Mattis is the grown-up in the room, maybe the only grown-up in the room when you look at Trump's cabinet and White House staff. Did you get a sense of that?
I think so. As I was listening to the interview, I was kind of blown away by how much respect he had for Teddy and the high level of conversation they were having. And I think that that mature, poised demeanor that he's known for came through there.
Yeah, there was a lot of revealing answers that he gave, some that I think are actually newsworthy. Like, for example, we were talking about the differences between how the Obama and Trump administrations have been handling the Middle East. And he criticized Obama, saying that if he had listened to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton more, his foreign policy could have been better. And I think that was really interesting. There was a lot of other stuff, too, in there. We talked a lot about NATO and how Trump is pressuring other countries to pay more. And he said that the Obama and Bush administrations have been doing the exact same thing. Just Trump has said it much more bluntly. It just shows that he really respected us and took us seriously because he's willing to give those kinds of answers. I think a lot of news outlets have been covering the story about getting the story because we're a high school newspaper. But there are actually some things in there that are newsworthy. And it was awesome that he took the time to answer like that, because that's profound for a little newspaper like us to get something like that.
Yeah,
no, for sure. What do you think the mainstream media is not getting right about General Mattis?
Not that much. I mean, most of the articles I've read about him praise him for being an intellectual as well as a great soldier. But one of the things that's kind of funny is that he really doesn't like his nickname.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, he hates being called Mad Dog. He said that it was more of a media concoction. None of his soldiers really called him that. I think his call sign in Iraq was actually Chaos. That's a little more intimidating to me. That's what they called him. He just told me that he goes by Jim, and I think he's pretty casual because he's from the West Coast.
I know a lot of people work for their high school paper because, you know, they got to do extracurricular activities. But do you want to pursue journalism? Did you? Or do you now more than ever?
Yeah, it's definitely, I've been doing it since sophomore year and I just graduated, and it's definitely something that I had always kind of been considering, and after this have definitely been looking at it more.
Teddy?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's not off the table. For me, I think one of the reasons why I ask good policy questions is because I'm really interested in the military. So I'm not taking off the table military or any kind of political career, but journalism is still up there.
Well, whatever your future, it sounds like you're a great reporter team right now, so keep asking questions.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That was Jane Gormley and Teddy Fisher, two students from Mercer Island High School who scored an interview with Secretary of Defense James Mattis. We've barely mentioned Mattis's boss on the show today, but there is an update to President Trump's travel ban that I want to tell you about. A judge in Hawaii has ruled that the temporary ban on travelers from six Muslim-majority nations must exempt them if they have grandparents already in the U.S. The Trump administration had limited exemptions to close family members, which, according to the State Department, did not include grandparents and grandchildren. The judge said that defied common sense, and he ordered the change. This isn't the last word on the travel ban, though. The Supreme Court is scheduled to hear arguments in the fall. And before we go, some quick thoughts on President Trump's visit to Paris. There were, let's say, some interesting moments between the French and American presidents and first ladies, including Trump's "she's in great shape" comment. Enough said. It was also awkward to see the Trumps and Macrons dining before the sun had set. Who eats dinner in France during daylight hours, even in the summer? And then there was this. A French military band performing for Trump and Macron a medley of songs by Daft Punk. Yes, the French electro-funk act. Trump seemed nonplussed, Macron smiled, and some of his cabinet ministers got down to some serious seat dancing. Anyway, the French military doesn't quite make our audition, désolé, so we leave you with Daft Punk's original. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Monsieur Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman, and we'll see you back here on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.